verses this morning are written by the Reverend Augusta
Chapin, who was the first woman ordained by the Universalist Church of America in 1863. Let these be our opening words. The greatest name will perish from human history. The finest monument crumble into dust, and the time will come when our places know us no more. Yet we shall survive in the memories of our friends as long as the remembrance will serve any good purpose, and then our work and thought and influence will mingle with the great ocean of human achievement, and the sum total will be something more, something different from what it would have been without us. This is our time when we take some moments to reflect with one another, and after a period of reflection in words and in silence, Brian will play some music for us to be able to light candles in the windows in memory and hope. So first we'll take some moments of words, then we'll take some moments of silence, and then candles. Let us turn to poet Mary Oliver for her words that I have excerpted for our meditation in words this morning. In Blackwater Woods. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. To make an offering to the life force. 2 weeks ago, I preached a sermon in which I referred to this congregation's days, months, years of disagreements, and I sought to acknowledge the pain of the spirit that nearly all of you suffered at some time during those disagreements. My hope was that I could give you some resources to help you in your spiritual healing. Well, evidently, I wasn't clear enough in my sermon, because a number of you misunderstood my words and thought that I was trying to, quote, rehash the past and, quote, look down on us. I was asked to promise never to mention anything again about the difficulties that you went through, not ever again. Now, my hope is that those of you who are still in some spiritual pain will recognize that my motives were of the best. And I cannot promise to quit offering you my perspectives when I think that they would help you in your spiritual growth. That is my job as your minister this year. It is the job of all ministers. And that is one of the values of our faith. What is our faith for if not to offer some perspectives on life as we live it, especially during a period of transition such as you are going through in this congregation and as our world is going through? Our religion can be a beacon of light and a source of energy and courage as we venture into the unknown. Today I want to speak about religion as a force that sustains us in our personal, individual struggles. A thinker who has greatly influenced me in my own struggles is Ernest Becker. Ernest Becker died in 1973, just months before his master work, The Denial of Death, won the Pulitzer Prize. It took me a long time to read this book. Initially, I kept picking it up and putting it down, and I find that that still happens as I go through it, rereading it. What Becker seeks to do is to help us understand the tasks of religion. And he says that that task is to deal with the inevitability of death and with the responsibility of making the most of the life we are given to live. Religion seeks to enable us to make meaning out of the arbitrariness and ambiguity of life. Now, Ernest Becker's thesis is that we are all of us, terrified of dying. Since we fear death, we strive to stave off our fear and repress our knowledge that we will someday die. And to do this, he says, we take on what he calls immortality projects, creations that we make to assuage our awareness that we and all around us will eventually perish. In fact, our entire culture could be called an immortality project. Becker says that all of our immortality projects are based on the illusion that we will live forever. He uses the word illusion not as a magic trick or anything of that sort, but he means a story or a myth. All of our life is based on illusion. There is no other way to keep ourselves going. But the important thing to consider is on what level of illusion we live. Is our illusion one that constricts us and binds us to material possessions and harmful relationships? Or do we live on the level of illusion that sustains us and encourages us in creative living? That is the main question for Becker, the main criterion he employs to determine what is most constructive in life. Now, it may surprise you to know that Becker supports and affirms true religion. For him, true religion is the illusion or myth that offers the maximum opportunity for freedom, dignity, and hope. In other words, true religion is the highest level of illusion that we can attain. Since we need illusion in order to continue living in this world, the best thing we can do for ourselves and the world is to seek the illusion that is most constructive, that offers the most hope, freedom, and dignity. Now, perhaps these are qualities that you have not in the past associated with religion. Religion, or what claims to be such, can indeed be devoid of freedom, as when persons insist that they act under some vast, immutable, supernatural plan or design, whether that design be for good or for harm. Religion, or what claims to be such, can indeed be devoid of dignity, as when people debase and enslave one another in the name of and with the sanction of some god who they believe has commanded them to do so. And religion, or what claims to be such, can indeed be devoid of hope, as when some declare that others who do not agree with them are the unsaved, the damned, hopeless, and somehow less than human. Becker would say that these are distortions of religion. They are illusions of a lower level. But true religion is another matter altogether. I want you to know a story from my own life, a time when religion's freedom, dignity, and hope enabled me to live through a situation that appeared on the surface to be meaningless and hopeless. It was the high illusion of religion that helped me see the below the surface into the depth dimension and envision the possibilities of larger life. The reason for my telling you my story is to reflect on an experience that many of us have undergone. I want to let you know how I was held and changed, and my best hope is that my story will be of some help to those of you who have already faced a situation like mine, and for those of you who will face one in the future. First, I want to explain the grounding image or metaphor that supports my story, and then the story itself, and then at the end, some reflections on the meaning of my life. The image that I call an anchoring or grounding image for my life is that of alchemy. The picture I get in my mind when I think of alchemy is that of a medieval wizard or charlatan who claims to be able to change base metals into gold. But it's the second dictionary definition of alchemy that is closer to the image that I want to explore. A power or process of transforming something common into something precious. I think that my youngest brother, Tom, had this second definition in mind when he wrote to me a few years ago. Tom was the one who used the word alchemy first. He said, quote, "You are a person who always..." My God, yes, always. I hadn't thought of it in quite those terms before. "Turns situations for the best and finds what good there is there. I picture you performing this alchemy slowly, deliberately, inexorably, wearing down the forces of evil and confusion by dint of savage stubbornness." Well, my brother's words are clearly colored by his affection for me. He's overlooking my very mixed motivations and relations with others, and perhaps he should be the theologian. He points to the deeper reality in which we can all participate. I have incorporated his words into my own personal mantra. I find that they are useful and encouraging and can keep me going even during the many times when I feel I'm being worn down under the forces of evil and confusion. And I think I know what Tom is speaking about when he speaks of alchemy. I can best explore this image by describing an event in my life that was a turning point for me, that forced me to understand the meaning of change, of transformation, of alchemy. Early on the morning of May 5th, 1978, a police officer came by my home to tell me that my husband, Perk, his name is short for Perkins, had been in a serious automobile accident and was in the hospital critically injured. She could give me no details. As I drove to the hospital in Maryland from our home in Northern Virginia, the sky lightened enough so that I could begin to make out the shapes of the trees along the then quiet George Washington Parkway. It wasn't quite dawn. In the words of the hymnal, "We see not yet the full day here, but we do see the paling night." In the half light, I had no idea if Perk were still alive. I only knew that I would need all of my strength for whatever lay ahead. As the sky grew lighter, I gradually arrived at the realization that I would indeed have the strength I needed. I saw that the universe was proceeding undisturbed. Dawn was breaking. I knew then the inexorability of life and death, and I determined to be fully engaged in whatever life asked of me. I knew that I was involved in events that were out of my control, but that I would use all of my powers to participate in them. Nature was in no way changed. The sun was rising as usual, but I knew that I would never be the same. Nor would Perk. During the 10 days that he lay in a coma in the intensive care unit, I watched him growing steadily more and more dependent upon the life support system. In life, he had been ebullient, impatient, impractical, always in motion, giving off sparks of static electricity wherever he went. He always craved center stage. In fact, we met each other on stage in a community theater production where we each had bit parts. And I was the one constantly pouring oil on the water that he had troubled. Now he was again center stage, but this time immobile, silent, unthinking, unbreathing. I shared Perk's stillness, but that was later. For the first few days, I spent hours every day talking to him. I cried, I raged, I encouraged him. I supported him on his journey. I trusted him to have the strength to let go. I wanted to instill love and courage into him, the love and courage that I was receiving from those around me. And after saying to him everything I had always wanted to say, and what a gift of time that was. A few days later, I fell silent and did not speak to him or touch him again. It was ended between us. And now the time I spent with him was taken up with the sound, the hiss of the ventilator, the gentle whirring of the pumps, the flutter of the EKG, and the steady drip of the IV fluid. Outside of the intensive care unit, I was pure organization. I was in touch with many, many people every day. I found that I gained stability from going to my office at the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C., every day, even if just for a short time. I arranged tasks for those who wanted to help. I participated with my church choir in both Sunday services as usual, and I had attended gatherings to meet the minister who was candidating with us for that pulpit all during that week. As a matter of fact, some of you may know the name of that minister. It was one of your former ministers, George Kimmick Beach. I signed the release forms for organ donation at the hospital on the day of our 9th anniversary, and I kept in communication with the doctors and nurses. I wrote endlessly in my journal. I found that I could carry on conversations while my tears flowed and nobody minded. Ministry came alive for me in those death-filled days. The Unitarian Universalist Church continued to be a major focus in my life, from my friends there, the music, our minister-to-be, and the concern and love of the community. I was supported and ministered to. And at the same time, I felt called to minister to others. So many persons wanted to tell me what Perk had meant to them, and then they went on to reflect on their own lives and its meaning. They seemed to look to me for guidance and support in their sorrow. When I arranged Perk's memorial service, I wanted it to be an occasion for the community to share with one another the feelings that they had been sharing with me. I believed that we all needed to remember together, to grieve together, to begin to heal together, and to come to know one another and ourselves. as death touched us all. There was alchemy in the religious community, not only during the memorial service as we recognized the Perkins we had known, but before and afterwards as well. People joined in a community of support for me, thus strengthening themselves. And at the same time, they reaffirmed me in my ministry to them, even when I felt that I was at my weakest. There was alchemy in the larger world, too. One could question whether we should have simply pulled the plug instead of allowing Perk to remain on life support for 10 days. Ethically, one could ask if we should have used so many resources, financial, emotional, and otherwise, on a non-living being. My reading and thinking in bioethics since then has convinced me that we, the medical staff and I, did the right thing. If we had simply pulled the plug, the organs would have been ruined from lack of oxygen. And as it was, the recipients of Perk's kidneys and corneas, who will remain forever unknown to me, have been granted a chance for a better life, a transformed life. They may have experienced alchemy. And of course, my life has been transformed. In some ways, both images of alchemy have been valid. Once I perceived life as if it were a base metal, but now I value it as gold. Death has touched me and transformed me so that now I know life's fragility and preciousness. Although I felt that an important part of me had died along with Perk, I also decided that I would go on living, and this was a very clear decision. It is a sign of my grace-filled existence that I am far from being gold myself, and yet I daily experience the alchemy and transformation of life. Now, thinking back on the events of so many years ago, I am aware of how religion helped me through that most difficult time. I found great comfort in the values of my Unitarian Universalist Church. I found comfort again almost 5 years ago when my best friend was killed of head injuries very similar to Perk's, after being struck by a truck while bicycling. Then, too, organ donation was very important for all of us survivors. And that comfort was present in September of 06 when my mother died. Specifically, when put to the test, the religion illusion came through for me in all of these cases. You remember Ernest Becker's formulation that the level of illusion is best that allows us to live most creatively with the most freedom, hope, and dignity. Very briefly, here are some ways in which my Unitarian Universalist religion illusion supported me while Perk was dying and after he was dead. First, freedom. Perk's death offered me a kind of freedom that I never would have anticipated, a spiritual freedom. Much as I missed him and longed for him, gradually I began to see that I still retained the gift of life and that it was my job to live it as completely as possible. I found a new freedom. I no longer fear my own death. Death will come for me sooner or later, and I only hope that I can continue to live until then to the fullest. Second, dignity was also a part of my new realization of how religion offered me new possibilities. We tried at all times to maintain Perk's dignity while he was in the hospital, and I will be forever grateful to the staff for their compassionate and competent care of him and me. He did indeed die with dignity, and I would wish that for all of us. And third, hope. Hope was so important in my continuing to live. It was from the very beginning unrealistic to hope for Perk's restoration to life, given the extent of his injuries. But I could certainly hope to be restored. An abiding and deep sense of hope led me to leave my former career and life behind in order to enter seminary that summer to study for the Unitarian Universalist ministry. And the ministry has, in turn, shown me new ways to bring hope to others, new ways that religion can offer possibilities of larger life. His donated organs, at that time we could only take kidneys and corneas, but those organs have brought new hope to persons in the world someplace. How can hope be any more tangible than that? Ernest Becker says it so well in the very last line of his book, and it must be my last line to you today. He says, the most any one of us can seem to do is to fashion something, an object, or ourselves, and drop it into the confusion, make an offering of it, so to speak, to the life force. Let us find the courage and the will to make our offerings to the life force today and every day. So may it be. And let these be our parting words today. Go forth into the world in peace. Be of good courage. Hold fast that which is good. Render to no one evil for evil. Strengthen the faint-hearted. Support the weak. Help the afflicted. Love all beings. Serve the Most High, rejoicing in the power of the Spirit. Alleluia. Amen. Blessed be.